You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 16th of August 2012. Midori House is brought to you in association with Thailand. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London with me, Hugo MacDonald. Coming up in the next 60 minutes, we test the waters of the escalating diplomatic row between Ecuador and Britain following the announcement earlier that Julian Assange will be granted asylum by the South American country.
Basically, Julian Assange as an individual has done a lot for society as a whole. He stands up for freedom of speech, exposing the lies of the government and the secrets that go on between governments across the world. America just being one.
Freedom of speech is one of our basic fundamental human rights, and for them to take his human right away is to just take it away from all of us.
That was protesters outside the Ecuadorian embassy in London. We'll also hear how and ask why Argentina's president Cristina Kirchner is transforming herself into an expert orator. We'll be joined by architecture critic Rowan Moore, who's succeeded in writing a book about architecture that isn't just for architects. And we'll be talking toilets.
The exhibition has a lot of technology, from using worms and larvae and black soldier flies to all kind of very high technology, and also some are very, very low cost appropriate technology, which I like the most.
More on that later. All that plus Monocle's photo director Poppy Shibamoto will tell us the secrets behind some of the more beautiful pictures in the new issue of Monocle, and we'll play some music too. That's all to come in the next hour here on Midori House. But first, let's get the latest headlines from around the world with Roger Crisp.
Monocle 24 News. South African police opened fire today on thousands of striking miners armed with machetes and sticks at Lonmin's Marikana platinum mine, leaving several bloodied corpses lying on the ground. For the National Union of Mine Workers, Franz Bellany made this statement.
Any of our members, if they can be found to be involved one way or another with violent activity, the NUM will deal with those members. We are also appealing that the police and law enforcement agents must fully investigate this carnage which led to 10 people, but to ensure that there is successful prosecution.
And earlier today, Lonmin had said that striking workers would be fired if they did not return to work. Ecuador's foreign minister has announced that his government will be granting political asylum to the WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange, who took refuge in their London embassy in June to avoid extradition to Sweden for questioning on alleged sex offences. Mr. Assange is fearful of being extradited from Sweden to America, where his WikiLeaks work is liable to see him facing a possible death penalty for espionage offences. There'll be more on this story in Midori House immediately after this news. The United Nations Emergency Relief Coordinator Valerie Amos, on a visit to Syria and Lebanon, says the number of Syrians needing help has risen to 2.5 million.
I have called on more than one occasion for all of those engaged in the fighting to remember that civilians need to be protected. And I'm concerned about the kinds of pictures and stories that we're hearing increasingly about the impact of the violence.
Meanwhile, French Foreign Minister Laurent Fabius has arrived in Beirut to hold talks with Lebanese officials for discussions on the Syrian crisis and the Lebanese aid response. Also, Russia has told the United States today that it favours a continued United Nations presence in Syria. Thousands of people from India's northeast residing in the south have fled from the southern city of Bangalore today as fears grew of a backlash over violence against Muslims in the state of Assam and nearby Myanmar state of Rakhine. Muslims across India have been alarmed by clashes in recent weeks between indigenous people in the northeastern state of Assam and Muslim settlers from neighbouring Bangladesh. About 75 people have been killed and more than 400,000 displaced. 11 people have been killed in a helicopter crash in southern Afghanistan. The Taliban is claiming to have shot down the Black Hawk ISAF aircraft, although the crash is under investigation. NATO Brigadier General Gunter Katz gave more details.
An ISAF helicopter crashed in Kandahar province today, resulting in the death of 7 American soldiers, 3 Afghan National Security Force members, and 1 Afghan civilian interpreter. The crash is still under investigation.
A Russian Aeroflot jet carrying around 200 passengers from New York to Moscow has made an unscheduled stop in Iceland following a bomb threat claiming that 5 suitcases would explode when the plane reached Moscow. A search of the plane is still underway at Keflavik Airport. And staying in Scandinavian climes, a Norwegian driver today found that even the best of intentions can bring problems. He swerved his car on a rural road some 225 kilometres north of Oslo in an attempt to avoid running into a moose, but unfortunately then hit a bear that was lurking nearby. And that's the news here on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Roger. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24.
Están escuchando Monocle 24.
Dobro pozdravljat, Monocle 24.
Esse é Monocle 24.
Monocle 24.
Estar Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
Det här är Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
It's 1906 in Stockholm, 1806 in London, and 1206 in Quito, the capital of Ecuador. And for 2 months, Julian Assange has been holed up in the Ecuadorian embassy in London, and today he was granted asylum by Ecuador. The British Foreign Office responded by announcing that it would not be deterred in its binding obligation to extradite Assange to Sweden, where he's wanted for question over 2 rape allegations. The diplomatic row between Ecuador and the UK is mounting. We'll be talking in a moment to our foreign editor, Steve Bloomfield, but first we're joined by James Savage, managing editor of The Local, based in Stockholm. James, thank you very much for joining us. I've just come back from 5 days in Sweden, and there was no mention really of Julian Assange in the papers there. I just wonder what the press has been saying today after this announcement.
I think the press has been unsurprised. Journalists here and people in general and politicians are all taking pretty much the same line, which is one of dismay and of frustration that once again the execution of justice in Sweden has been impeded by what they see as a sort of an unserious and an uncomprehending attitude on the part of this time of the Ecuadorian authorities.
We're hearing that Ecuador's ambassador has been summoned to Stockholm. Can you give us any more of an update on this?
Yeah, he was. He's been summoned to the foreign ministry, where we're told he was due to be told that the Ecuadorians' actions were unacceptable, and that Sweden protested that Ecuador was trying to halt the Swedish judicial process and to frustrate European judicial cooperation, being the implementation of the European arrest warrant that Sweden had issued last year.
And what about sort of the feeling on the ground in Stockholm and in Sweden? Is it something that people are talking about and are outraged, or is it sort of only up in the higher echelons that people are sort of saying with dismay, like you say, that this is an abuse of the asylum instrument?
Yeah, I think people here are genuinely cross on all sorts of levels. I think people are genuinely cross that Swedish justice has been insulted in the way that it has been insulted. You know, that you've had Assange and his supporters saying that he won't get a fair trial, and that somehow this is all a smokescreen to get him extradited to the US on for espionage charges. So people are cross about that, and then yes, people are cross about the fact that Ecuador has taken this stand and has tried to frustrate what they see as a perfectly reasonable and routine case of sexual assault and rape.
James Savage, managing editor of The Local in Stockholm, thank you for joining us. And Steve Bloomfield, Monocle's foreign editor, is in the studio now. I mean, Steve, it is outrageous that sort of the diplomatic row that is escalating. So minute by minute, we're hearing reports, and William Hague has just given a statement confirming that there will be no safe passage for Mr. Assange out of the United Kingdom, and that there's no legal basis for us to do so, that the UK doesn't recognise the principle of diplomatic asylum. I mean, there really is no budging on this. So what happens?
Let's put this in a bit of context. Asylum is for
you know, people who feel they are going to be tortured, people who feel their human rights are going to be infringed, people who feel they are going to be unfairly treated in some way. It is not for people who are accused of rape or sexual assault. And that is what Sweden wants to extradite, why they want to extradite him. They actually didn't want to extradite him at all. They invited him to come to Sweden to answer charges because they said there were some very serious charges. There was a case to be answered. They asked him to come. He refused. They then sought his extradition. The British government, after much, after a long legal case, said, yes, he must go. This idea that somehow he will be, as soon as he's off to Sweden, he's going to be spirited off to the US because of some charges which actually, frankly, no one has quite laid out yet, is just utter nonsense. And one other thing about this this suggestion of charges in the US and a possible extradition. The UK, I'm fairly sure, has quite a decent relationship with the US. If the US wants to extradite anyone from this country, they can do that. And they have, you know, whether that's controversial cases like Gary McKinnon, who's a computer hacker with Asperger's who hacked into the Pentagon's computer system. You know, the US had no problem with trying to extradite him from the UK, and the UK had no problem with agreeing. So this whole idea that, you know, this is all a CIA plot and a cover-up and he's going to go to Sweden and then he'll be taken off to the US is not only nonsense, but it completely undermines the whole idea of political asylum.
We've had some quite strong comments, not least from the president of Ecuador, Rafael Correa, has said no one's going to terrorise us. I mean, this is sort of escalating quite quickly. And, you know, where does it go from here in terms of sort of diplomatic relations between Ecuador and the UK?
Well, I had no idea the president of Ecuador was an idiot, but he's clearly an idiot. You know, this isn't about Britain or anyone else terrorising Ecuador. This is about a man who is accused of sexually assaulting two women in Sweden and he's refusing to go there to face those charges and to face that case. That's what it's about. It's not about Britain trying to throw its weight around. It's, you know, I saw earlier that the American filmmaker Michael Moore, you know, who made a very good film, Roger and Me, 20 years ago, and Fahrenheit 9/11 was pretty good as well to a certain extent, saying there must be protests outside the embassy because the British government is trying to arrest the journalist who told the truth about Iraq. It's the idea that because you, quote, told the truth about Iraq, you therefore don't have to follow the law like the rest of us is frankly outrageous. And people who are defending him on this should really be ashamed of themselves.
But also, I mean, you mentioned Michael Moore there. Occupy Wall Street have called on people to take part in a 24/7 occupation of the British consulate in New York. It seems that there's a huge sort of misunderstanding, or rather a clouding, of sort of what the issues are at stake that you've outlined, that he has just been called to answer for accusations of rape in Sweden. You know, how, what's the need? Do you just need to go and shake these people in the streets and say, listen, this is what's happened?
I think you cannot repeat enough the fact that he is accused of raping two women. People on the left traditionally have been supporters of the victims of rape, not those accused of rape. And I think those that are supporting Assange today should have a very long, hard look at themselves.
Hard words indeed there from Monocle's foreign editor, Steve Bloomfield. Thank you for joining us. You're listening to Midori House. We'll be off to Argentina after this.
Thailand is the world's largest exporter of rice, shipping more grains abroad than any other nation. Perhaps even more surprisingly, we're also the world's leading producer of hard disk drives, powering global electronics. And we also make great music. So from sound bites to megabytes, you could say that we're making all the right noises. To find out more, visit modern-thailand.com.
The September issue of Monocle is a global survey of flashpoints and fighting forces. In this inaugural defence-themed issue, our editors put on their flak jackets and pop on their helmets as they investigate everything from how to create a modern fighting force to how to design state-of-the-art camouflage. And we have lots more to offer too.
In the culture section this month, world-renowned war reporters and photographers reveal the contents of their kit bags before they gear up to ship off to the world's trouble spots. In Berlin, Y magazine opens up its editorial for military inspection. Galgalat's radio in Tel Aviv gets uniforms to spin hits. And we look at how Bollywood's dealing with India's military ambitions.
in the design section, we're granted access to Oscar Niemeyer's staggering Army Command headquarters in Brasilia. We also meet the tailor responsible for the most colourful military uniforms, those of the Swiss Guard in the Vatican City.
In the edit section, we take you to the Suomenlinna Sea Fortress in Helsinki in search of the best property deals. We also travel to Germany to see through the lens of the greatest binocular makers in the world.
The battle-ready September issue of Monocle is on newsstands now and also available via subscription at monocle.com. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
Welcome back. It's 18:15 here in London. It's 2:15 in Buenos Aires. Argentinians and political commentators are suddenly talking about a new loosened up, relaxed style in Argentinian President Cristina Kirchner. Her national speeches on TV, or stand-up acts as they're becoming known, are getting more and more frequent, and some say entertaining. Joining us on the line to tell us a little bit more about this oratorical makeover of Argentina's glamorous leader is Marcia Carmo, a BBC Brazil journalist based in Buenos Aires. Marcia, thank you very much for joining us. Maybe you could just start by telling us a little bit about what you think the president is up to.
Oh, yes. Cristina Kirchner, as you said, has a new style. In the last month, she decided to increase the straight, direct communication with the Argentines. But as you said, and as Beatriz Sarlo, an Argentine analyst, said, Cristina is doing something like a stand-up.
Is this stand-up, though, in the way that we understand it in English as being sort of comedy? Or is it stand-up in terms of just being very sort of direct and being about the spoken word?
No, here the analysts are talking about a stand-up like there in England. People here are criticizing Cristina Kirchner because her new style is very or too much relaxed. During her speech, Cristina couldn't talk about everything, economic or international issues, for example, but she never ever talk about the most important issue nowadays in Argentina, like inflation. And she's very, during her speeches, she's very relaxed. She can laugh, but at the same time, she can cry. As analysts say here, first, Cristina has adopted a widow style, including crying in front of the cameras. And nowadays, she's very funny. She can talk about the Hugo Chavez president hair, or she can talk about Brazil, or she can talk about bad things about an employee or a businessman. She can talk about everything. So it seems like a stand-up.
Okay. I mean, so like you say, she's talking about everything except maybe the things that most of the people want to hear about or at least want to know that the president is addressing. But you mentioned there Hugo Chavez, and we obviously know that he is a remarkable orator. His speeches go on for days and there are very many of them. Do you think that Cristina Kirchner has sort of looked across and seen, you know, maybe this is a style that might work for her?
Cristina nowadays has maybe she has the support of poor people. Her new style is being criticized by middle class and highest class. In fact, they don't agree with her new style and with her government, but poorest people like her and like her government. But the problem is that Cristina is the only person who talks in her government. It's very difficult here to listen another authorities talking about the issues, economic issues, or another things about Argentina. She is the only person who talks about her government. So we have to listen everything because she is the only way to understand what is happening here in Argentina nowadays, in Argentina nowadays.
Well, at least she seems to be giving a good talk at the moment. We'll be keeping an eye on that in the future, definitely. Marcia Carmo in Buenos Aires, thank you very much. We're going to head north to Brazil for a song now. This is Rosa Menina Rosa by Seu.
Rosa, menina rosa, vem. Quero ver você sambar.
That was the beguiling Rosa Menina Rosa by Seu. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
Aus London, das ist Monocle 24.
De Londres, essa é a Monocle 24.
As with so much hard copy printed material, doom mongers predicted that travel guidebooks would go the way of the dodo thanks to the internet. Undeniably, business has suffered in the travel guide sector, but those that remain have offered something more precious than a restaurant listing or TripAdvisor hotel review. Often they become a cultural artefact in their own right, an editorialised interpretation of a city, region or country that's part travel journal, part history book and part guidebook. Something that unlocks the story of a place as you go along, and something that doesn't need Wi-Fi or 3G to work. But what happens when a guidebook is published at a turning point in a city or country's fortunes, say when war or natural disaster strikes, and overnight listings and observations become redundant? Well, joining us on the line is Tom Howells, editor of Blue Guides. Tom, thank you very much for joining us. I wonder maybe if you could explain a little bit, if you have any examples of when a guidebook that's you've published at Blue Guides has suddenly been affected by something that's happened that means that either, you know, the listings or the advice that's been given seems a bit out of date.
We had a few years ago, Hugo, a guidebook in the mid-90s, Blue Guides published a guidebook to, to Albania. I think its title by then was already Albania and Kosovo. Which was then engulfed in the war, which I think was sort of 97, 98. Now, the funny thing about that was that actually helped sales considerably. It was a very, always a pretty peripheral tourist destination, although a very interesting one, and a very well-written book by an author called James Pettifer, an expert in the region. But actually, the war was great, and we couldn't really understand why. When we looked into the sales, it turned out that most of the copies were being bought in the Washington area, and it was, of course, policymakers, journalists who knew absolutely nothing at all about a part of the world which suddenly had become very important, and a Blue Guide was the most comprehensive source available, and so that actually, in that case, it actually was a good story, not a bad story. There are counterexamples as well, of course.
Of course, I mean, something quite unique to the Blue Guides is the amount of history and cultural commentary that goes into your guidebooks, which I can imagine would suddenly be a fantastic handbook to people who were going in, journalists or people, policymakers, like you say, wanting to understand an area that isn't necessarily so well covered. But I mean, say something like The Lonely Planet to Syria, something that I used myself when I was in Syria about a decade ago and found when I was moving house recently. Is that all but redundant now, do you think?
Well, there's a sort of a small area of collecting, which is collecting old guidebooks and wanting to have special or interesting editions. Whether A Lonely Planet to Syria is ever going to be top of a collector's list, I don't know. I mean, I could be wrong. Who knows? But the problem is that they will have, you know, Lonely Planet is a very successful series. I don't know how many they would have printed out, 20,000 books maybe, and those are all floating. Many of them are floating around somewhere. There's not going to be any rarity. There might be some curiosity value, but there's no rarity value. If you want rarity, you have to go for something like Baedeker's, you know, one of the great names in guidebooks. Blue guys trace their descent from Baedeker in the around the time of the First World War. But Baedeker actually kept going throughout the Second World War, but they were helping with their Nazi war effort by producing guidebooks to occupied countries. Now, a good example is the guidebook for German soldiers to Rome, their Rome guidebook, which they produced in 1944. By the time it had been...
I can imagine that's very collectible nowadays.
Yeah, well, it was very collectible, particularly because by the time it came out, came off the presses, that the Germans were driven back from Rome, were out of Rome, and the entire print run was pulped, and the three remaining copies were extremely valuable.
I mean, moving away from the slightly sort of misfortunate or, in some cases, very fortunate examples that we've spoken about, as a guidebook publisher today, what do you do? Do you try and update the guidebooks that are, of which there are numerous, say, to London or any of the sort of big cities around the world? Or do you try and sort of get first dibs on somewhere that really is totally unexplored and become the only one in the market?
Well, that's absolutely a good question. That's a conundrum, I think, for all guidebook publishers. Do you produce yet another guidebook to Rome? Last time I looked, which was a year or two ago, there were 212 English language ready available, generally distributed guidebooks to Rome. Do you want to be the 213th guide to Rome? I mean, in the case of the Blue Guide, yes, we do probably one of the best guidebooks to Rome for the right sort of person, and we do want to do another guidebook to Rome. But if you're looking at what to publish books to, then there's the other model. There's some excellent, smaller, independent guidebook publishers like Brat, for example, who specialised on the more obscure destinations and done it very well. We're now about to do a guidebook to Staten Island, which is one of New York's boroughs, but that's a fairly minority. That doesn't have a whole lot of tourists. But again, it'll be the only guidebook to Staten Island. So there are different strategies, as you say, one of trying to be the reach the parts other guidebooks don't reach, or the other of doing what everyone else does, but do it better or more focused. I think the whole...
Exactly. You
know, with diverse... People's tastes are diversifying. The world is fragmenting. You can divide up Rome or London into any number of different areas of interest.
Still find something new to say about it.
Still find something new. The internet, of course, is a competitor because the internet's quite good at that. But equally, the internet is not very curated or edited. If you want reliable information, you might prefer to go to a known name in travel publishing.
Indeed. Well, Tom Howells, editor of the Blue Guides, thank you very much for joining us. You're listening to Midori House.
Music to Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
In the next half hour of the programme, we'll be talking to author Rowan Moore about his new book, Why We Build. And we'll be hearing the latest in toilet technology.
The exhibition has a lot of technology, from using worms and larvae and black soldier flies to all kind of very high technology. And also some very, very low cost appropriate technology, which I like the most.
But first, here's Roger Crisp with the news headlines.
Thanks, Hugo. South African police opened fire today on thousands of striking miners armed with machetes and sticks at Lonmin's Marikana platinum mine. Latest reports claim that 18 people have been killed. Ecuador's foreign minister has announced that his government will be granting political asylum to the WikiLeaks founder, Julian Assange, who took refuge in their London embassy in June to avoid extradition to Sweden, from where he is fearful of in turn being extradited to America, where his WikiLeaks work is liable to see him facing a possible death penalty for espionage offences. The United Nations Emergency Relief Coordinator Valerie Amos, on a visit to Syria and Lebanon, says the number of Syrians needing help has risen to 2.5 million. Meanwhile, Russia has told the United States today that it favours a continued presence of the UN in Syria. Thousands of people from India's northeast residing in the south have fled from the southern city of Bangalore today as fears grew of a backlash over violence against Muslims in the state of Assam and nearby Myanmar state of Rakhine. A Russian passenger jet carrying around 200 passengers en route from New York to Moscow has made an unscheduled stop in Iceland following a bomb threat, claiming that five suitcases would explode when the plane reached Moscow. And 11 people, including seven US soldiers and three Afghan allies, have been killed in a helicopter crash in southern Afghanistan. And those are the headlines here on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Roger. It's 23:03 in New Delhi, 18:33 in London, 10:33 in Las Vegas. You're listening to Midori House live from Studio One in London. Coming up next, we'll be talking to Rowan Moore about his new book, Why We Build. But before that, time for a song. This is Architecture in Helsinki with Do the Whirlwind. That was Do the Whirlwind by Architecture in Helsinki. The time in London is 18:36. You're listening to Midori House. Books about architecture often fall into two camps. Tomes of beautiful photographs that gather dust on coffee tables, otherwise irritatingly known as architecture porn. Or at the other end of the spectrum, there are those with too many long technical words and drawings written by architects for architects. Architecture seemingly is a difficult topic to write a book about if you want to engage anyone beyond the industry. But Rowan Moore, a trained architect, critic and former director of the Architecture Foundation, has succeeded in writing a book about architecture that is unusually enjoyable and engaging, and not just for architects. It's called Why We Build, and Rowan joins me now. Thank you for coming in, Rowan.
Well, thank you, and for that terrific intro.
Is it fair, though? I mean, do you think that architecture books fail to capture the imagination of people outside the architecture industry?
Yes, that is fair. To be honest, I don't read that many architecture books myself. There are a few gems, but quite often just reading words about architecture is quite tiring and difficult.
And was that something that you set out to actively avoid?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, what interests me in writing for a newspaper about architecture is the possibility of explaining it to people who are not architects, which is not always easy to do, but... That's the kind of task I set myself, without dumbing down, without saying stupid things.
No, exactly. And this is also something that I think is a big problem with architecture industry in general, is that on the one hand, you want to try and explain the importance of buildings to daily life and the fact that you don't have to be a trained architect to appreciate good architecture or to understand it. But architects themselves are so bad at talking about their buildings.
And architects don't usually... happen to be word people, which is why they're architects. They're space people and image people, which is fantastic. But that means when they open their mouth, they don't necessarily communicate very well. But the other thing is they always have to keep up appearances. They're always selling themselves. They can't really scare their clients or their potential clients. So a lot of the time they can't talk about what's really going on. And for me, what is amazing about architecture is that it is about human relationships and quite often quite crazy human relationships. So on one level, it's this incredibly serious, important thing that is very heavy and expensive, lasts a long time. On the other hand, it's often put up by people who are not always the most well-adjusted human beings, clients, architects, politicians, and then it's inhabited by everybody else who bring their own fantasies and desires and feelings to bear on them. And the building is this kind of mineral interval between one set of emotions of the people who make it and the set of the emotions of the people who inhabit it. And of course, it's never going to be a perfect fit between all these different desires. And really, that's the nub of what's interesting to me about architecture. So a building is a proposition, really. It's an idea about how things could be in the future, And then that proposition gets tested by the people who actually use it.
Absolutely. One of my favourite things that I read just this morning was about, you say we call them buildings rather than built because they carry on living. And kind of as you've just been explaining, it's people are the missing part that keep the building alive.
Yeah, absolutely.
How have you gone? I mean, looking at the book specifically, it's split into difference of emotions and journeys and things, but very personal to you and your sort of exploration of architecture and your idea of what architecture is about. Yeah. Maybe sort of describe a little bit about how the book's been put together.
Okay, well, it's got 10 books, like all great works of architecture, like going back to Vitruvius in the time of the early Roman Empire. But the 10 books are, each one relates to a different human concern or emotion. So like the idea of home, the idea of truth, money, sex, we have to have sex, of course. the idea of time, which is also life and death. So that's the structure of the book. And in each chapter, I tell stories that show how these different themes play out in particular examples, particular architects, particular times and places. It's a kind of world tour. I go to South America and Japan and
I'm so
Dubai.
Glad that you bring Lina Bobardi into the spotlight as well.
Yes. And the heroine of the book is Lina Bobardi, who in case you don't know, is a fantastic Brazilian architect who worked in Sao Paulo. She's now becoming very fashionable. Hopefully I've written the book just quick enough that I'm not accused of getting on the bandwagon. But I think she really understood how the architect has to put their feelings into a building, but they also have to leave space open for the people who come to inhabit it. It is both. You know, some people say that if buildings are about life, therefore the architect has to stand back and create an empty space for people to fill. Architects tend to think they've got to put all of themselves into the building and fill up the building with themselves. Really, it's both. You really need both. You need the architects to put their stuff in and you need everybody else to put their stuff in. And that's when it gets interesting.
Do you think that public are becoming more savvy when it comes to architecture? Or, I mean, in Britain, for instance, I feel that the British public is sort of scared of contemporary architecture.
I hope so. I mean, in the time that I've been writing about architecture, we have gone from, and when I started in the days when Prince Charles was rampant, and in those days, even getting people to think about a modern building as anything other than a monstrosity was difficult. So we've moved on from that. So people do appreciate new buildings, get excited. And, you know, I think something like the Shard has had a really positive reception. People are up for being excited by new buildings, but I think that there can be a kind of deepening of the understanding would be a good thing. And really, that's what I'm going to do with the book. I think too much of the discussion is at a pretty superficial level. So without getting kind of heavy and boring, I want people to discover more about what's good about buildings.
Well, we are counting down the days now till the Venice Architecture Biennale, where we're going to be doing a lot of radio from there too. And I wanted to ask you before you go what you're looking forward to, apart from the Prosecco and the Spritzers.
Well, the fact is it's directed by David Chipperfield is a good thing. He's a very smart architect. He's got a lot of good people in. I'll be looking out for what my friends at MUF Architecture and Art do, because that's always fun. I guess they'll be top of my list.
Fantastic. Rowan Moore, author of Why We Build, which is published by Picador and available to buy from the 30th of August. Thank you very much.
Yes, I expect you could order it on Amazon now.
Yes, pre-order it on Amazon now. It's a fascinating read. Thank you very much for joining us. We'll be talking toilets right after this.
Thailand's famous hospitality is ingrained in our culture. From the warmest of welcomes to our culinary skill. That's why hospitality businesses like the world's best cooking school, Le Cordon Bleu, come to Thailand to sample our unique mix of exquisite cuisine and transcendent service. And all this against a soundtrack of fantastic homemade music. To find out more, visit modern-thailand.com.
On the latest edition of the menu, Monocle 24's weekly food and drink show, we discover what a restaurateur is faced with when he wants to organize a pop-down event, that is, serving food 80 meters underground. We also get great lessons for baking amazing tarts, meet an American chef who has managed to break into the Italian food scene, and we head to the West Bank to find out what a 100-mile diet Palestinian style is.
Our concept was to create a new style of restaurant, serve just fresh food and natural food.
That's The Menu, premiering every Friday at 1900 hours UK time in association with Krug.
It's 1846 here in London. Welcome back to Midori House with me, Hugo MacDonald. Now, if you had a spare $370 million, would you throw it down the toilet? Well, that's pretty much what the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation did a year ago when they launched a worldwide competition to try and reinvent the loo in a bid to combat the grievous statistics on modern sanitation. This week, some of the more successful competition entries were revealed at a toilet fair in Seattle, where the Gates Foundation is headquartered. A little earlier, Sophie Grove and Clemency Burton Hill spoke to Jack Sim, founder of the sanitation NGO, the World Toilet Organization, who was at the event. They started by asking him about the criteria behind the competition.
You have to design something that is costing only 5 cents per day to use, and you can then design in any new ideas, because the toilet, the flush toilet, was invented about 200 years ago, and ever since that day until today, there is not much reinvention, and so the toilet looks almost the same. But 200 years ago, we have lots of water and very few people. Today, we have lots of people and very scarce water. So should we continue to use this system? And the new inventions is here to question. Right now, the exhibition has a lot of technology, from using worms and larvae and black soldier flies to all kind of very high technology. And also some are very, very low cost appropriate technology, which I like the most, because the poor does not have so much money. So if a toilet entire system costs $20 to $30, that is a very good price and very affordable for the poor.
And I wonder, Jack, whether or not that Bill and Melinda Gates are going to choose just one of these innovations, or are they going to roll out several of the entries from the competition? When do we expect to see these implemented in different communities around the world?
These are all different technology which have a different timeline. Some of them would be ready to roll. Others would take another several years before they can be commercialized. And when I say ready to roll, it still needs to be productized and packaged and sold in a way that people can easily use. So the criteria, I think, after the technology is how to market it, how to create behavioral change, because right now a lot of people are openly defecating outside, so they're just shitting on the ground, and the poop is attracting the flies and transmitting diseases. So how to move people from open defecation to defecating in a fixed place? In fact, it is a social event every morning and every evening for Indian ladies to meet their friends while they're going to the toilet along the roadside or going to the bush. So if they were to go into a toilet, it's a very lonely affair. They can't talk to their friends. They can't exchange notes about their mother-in-law and their husbands. So you have to replace this social event with something even more important, like an improvement in social status if you have a toilet.
And how difficult do you think it will be to effect that kind of social change? Because, I mean, it's one thing for the scientific developments to be initiated in a way. But as you say, that this is a fascinating social issue. And how easy do you think it will be to change people's behavioural patterns?
Yeah, then this means that we have to go and understand the psychology of the person living in a slum or living in a village, and how these people are aspirationally looking for something. For example, if you ask them to choose between a cell phone and a toilet, most villagers would prefer to buy a cell phone and not have to have and not have a toilet. So how do we then move the status of the toilet to higher or equivalent to the cell phone, so that if they have to choose because they have only so much money, they'll prefer to have a toilet? And as you know, people go to the shopping center and they buy things emotionally, and then they come home and rationalize them, like this is durable or why it is worth, or you save so much money after you spend so much money. So it's the same with the poor people. If you want them to buy something, they will look what are the rich people using on television. They saw things on television. They feel that the lifestyle of the rich is an aspirational lifestyle. So you might see people buying television although they didn't send their children to school. So how do we make them understand there's a lot of public education and there's a lot of social pressure? And if, for example, the village chief wife has a toilet, then she goes brag around to say, look at my beautiful toilet, it's so clean and it doesn't smell, and it really raised the status around the village, then a lot of people might start to have toilets.
And Jack, you mentioned that there were different sort of classes, you know, involved in this, but I wondered whether or not we expect to see, you know, these innovations coming into, you know, rich people's homes. I mean, Melinda Gates mentioned that herself. If this is done well, we might see it, these new inventions across the board. Which ones do you expect will really, you know, will see in homes all around the world?
There is one that I particularly like, which is a very slippery surface on the seat cover that is able to kill the pathogens on the seat cover surface, which I think is very, very good for a public toilet. Also, with this very slippery surface, you can coat the surface of the WC pen and the sheet will not stick on the side and will slide down. And thinking further, maybe we do not need a water seal, because if we coat the inside of the pipe with this slippery surface, we could all slide down rather than use water to flush it. So if we could just have a negative pressure so that the smell does not come back into the room, everything can slide down. So I am thinking this particular technology can be very, very promising if we have a sliding toilet and a sliding sewerage system instead of a flushing one. It will save us so much water, and we could use the water for so many other things.
I do hope people weren't eating whilst that was going on. It got a bit graphic towards the end, but that was Jack Sim, founder of the Sanitation NGO and World Toilet Organization. The time in London is 18:53. You're listening to Midori House. Now, each day this week, in celebration of the glorious new issue of Monocle hitting newsstands around the world, we've been looking at a different section of the magazine. Today it's the design section, and because I'm in the hot seat, we're joined by Monocle's photo director, Poppy Shibamoto, to talk us through the stunning photo direction she commissioned for this military special. Poppy, thank you very much for coming in.
Yeah, I brought you a wine.
Thank you. We're not supposed to say that live on air. But let's talk about the photos anyway. Kicking off things in the design section, we took a while to get permission from the Brazilian army to access their headquarters in Brasilia. But it was worth it, wasn't it?
Wasn't it? It's therefore we send photographer who's experienced and shot a lot for us before. So that, you know, you get the result. But somehow he asked me, I didn't tell you this before, but he asked me to shoot some film.
Oh, goodness. And this was right up against the wire as well. We only had about 2 days before we were left to go to print.
Well, the next day we went to print. As soon as we had the images, we went to print, didn't we? So
Okay, yeah. So there wasn't much room to manoeuvre, but thankfully the experienced photographer Andre Vieira did a fantastic job, didn't he, of this wonderful Oscar Niemeyer, huge sort of sculpture of a building in the middle of Brasilia. And it's the army headquarters. We've done quite a sort of reportage shoot, haven't we, where we've shown some of the soldiers at work.
I really like the very contrasty and very sunny, harsh light.
Isn't it? And these sweeping sort of concrete that really, it looks like liquid almost, frozen in time.
The tile. Yeah, it looks quite magical, doesn't it, that shot?
Luckily, it was a nice sunny day as well, which makes the contrast of the light and the shade even more extreme. I was thrilled with this story. Thank you very much.
Oh, good that you like it.
Moving to the end of section D, or the D section, actually, I should say, so we don't confuse it with the design show on the radio. We went to Okinawa, the Japanese islands south of Kyushu, and photographed the houses that were built for the American military in the 1950s, but have since been sort of recolonized by the Japanese population.
Exactly.
There.
There's a bakery, there's a rice store. It's really nice. It's very 50s, isn't it?
Isn't it? And it's amazing because you look at these buildings. We photographed, I think, 8 buildings in total that were all of this 1950s, very sort of prefab concrete style. Mm. They don't look that remarkable. And then suddenly you think, actually, this looks like suburban America. I can't believe this is in nearly tropical island.
It's very hard to believe that's Japan, like a corner of a...
Completely.
Japan,
and this is what so many of the stories of the people here say. It's, you know, they have more space in these buildings than they would ever have in a house that would have been built by Japanese.
Exactly. It has more, its ceiling is a bit higher, the doors a bit bigger, you know, bigger windows as well, probably good for wind to come through in the hot weather.
Exactly.
And then the tiling, that's quite new, I think. It's different in Japan. Like, you wouldn't have a tiled floor that much.
No, exactly.
You know, you wouldn't walk in your shoes, you'd take your shoes off. So those little details are quite nice to see.
And we've also told the story through the sort of details and rooms and some of the facades as well. You get a very good sense of what Okinawa feels like, this sort of dense vegetation. But a lot of young people moving back there as well.
Exactly,
from sort of mainland Japan. Well, Poppy, thank you very much for joining us. What's your favourite photo in the whole of the design section?
Design section? Okay.
You've got 5 seconds.
Gawker opening shot.
Okay, good. That's the amazing fashion story. Stop it. You've just come on here and said so much that it's out of bounds. Poppy Shibamoto, thank you very much for joining us here. Tomorrow we'll be looking at the edits section of the new issue of Monocle with the edits editor, Santiago Rodriguez Tarditi. But that's all we have time for today on Midori House. Thank you very much to our producer, Hannah Jenkins, our researcher, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and our studio manager, Ben Jay. Up next after the news is this week's episode of The Urbanist with Andrew Tuck. And in 3 hours' time, at 2200 hours here in London, Andrew Muller and Tamsin Smith will be back for the Monocle Daily. Tune in to hear Monocle's foreign editor, Steve Bloomfield. He'll be presenting Midori House at the same time tomorrow. But in the meantime, thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.